colon, speech body, energy body, radiance, that which moves between the finite and the infinite, and also between the finite and the finite, and mind body, which is a boundless consciousness. And so you have three levels, and you have to approach it. You have to approach it with your own understanding of those three levels. So often there are also three little steps. I mean, you can do the three ad nauseum, like on the Quaker Oats box. Mm-hmm. Is it Quaker Oats, or which box is it?
That Rice Krispies.
Is it Rice Krispies, where they're holding a box of the Rice Krispies?
Themselves?
And the,
yeah.
Which one is that?
I don't know. I see what you
mean. From childhood, it used to be right in front of my nose.
Was it chocolate? Was it? It was chocolate.
No, it was some kind of. I thought it was shredded wheat. I can't remember. One of those ones where the person is holding a box of it and pointing. He's wearing a Quaker hat. He's pointing at the box with a smile, and on that box that he's holding, there's a picture of him pointing at the box, and you can imagine. Right there.
Which is so bad.
Like that, you can do the law of three forever, or the law of five. They're both very powerful laws in the understanding of mind body and how they work together. But you basically have the law of three here. You have like the three doors of approaching, and you have the seven offering bowls, which basically represent the steps to total understanding. Because the first, are you almost sorry you asked?
No.
The first bowl, the first bowl is called water for drinking, because the very first thing you have to do is to cut down your thirst, and you have to also give that to the world, which is mirror like wisdom. Give to the world, you give to yourself. So the first thing you do is water for thirst, just to cut down the thirst, because if you're too thirsty, you can't see. The world is too thirsty, you can't see. So you have to be aware of where the consciousness is becoming and grasping into the future, mm-hmm. and be present in the present. So that's water for drinking. That's the first offering. Next offering is water for washing, and it usually says in parentheses, or it's insinuated, the feet. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you want a clear understanding.
This is your understanding.
And a clear understanding. You want to see clearly where you are, not where you could be or where you have been. You understand? None of it, we were talking just about that, about conditions, not about conditions. That is more insightful than not seeing conditions. But it will still lead one only to compassion, not to wisdom. So there's only half the story operating. And wisdom is to penetrate reality. Compassion is to see reality, and wisdom is to penetrate it. Mm. Nice trick if you can do it. Mm. So, washing the feet, that is to say, to clearly understand what is occurring here, or where one's standing is. Very powerful. And then the next one is flowers. Now, flowers always represent the energy fields, and then that's when the consciousness begins to attain wisdom. That is to say, it breaks down the barriers of consciousness, the barriers of perception, where you have one experience and then you know it forever, mm-hmm. and allows you to have the knowing, the perceptive mind, one experience and know it forever, while also being aware of the energy that something is not your perception of it, it also is an energy moving in the universe. So that's the flowers. They are both a fixed thing, the perceptive, and also a moving, mm-hmm. dancing energy field that is continuously changing and moving from, you know, seed to, mm-hmm. to bud, to flower, to falling apart. Right? And then the next one is incense, and that represents the sweet smell of success, basically. It's when you really actually become aware of both perception and the changing energy dance. And so then you begin to move the inner energy in accord, in harmony with the outer energy. So you're not in friction with it. So So it's a sweet smell. It's ethics, basically. It's treating things appropriately. And I mean, the angels love that, so they just gather around, you know, the more, and there are angels, different types of spirits and energies. The more you act in accord with how things are, the easier things get, because these angels just come dancing around you. Right to the point that you're going to make a breakthrough and act in another level of wisdom, at which point you always have to go through that kind of womb birth experience where things tighten up. You have to really decide you really do want to leave the reality you are dwelling in and move into another one, and there'll be lots of little tests of that, like, do you want to die while you're being born, or do you just want to be born? You know, and there'll be different little playings around with that one. Some people pass, they go through those passages really easily. I have not yet been one of those. And then the next one is light. So wisdom dawns when you act appropriately and work with the energy of what is. Then wisdom actually becomes consciously present. In Buddhism, there is a beautiful saying. It's like when you light a candle in a dark room, light that in darkness that has been there for centuries is dispersed in 1 second. I have to go around and light each square inch, you know. Like one moment of truth illuminates everything. It's very beautiful, isn't it? You don't have to go after each jot and tittle of ignorance that you're carrying around. Praise the Lord. Boy, I'd be jot and tittle the whole time, I'll tell you. And then the last one is, the second last one is perfumed. Everyone. It's basically the bodhicitta, just the conscious realization of the heart that is awakening within one's being, and the conscious realization of that makes it more powerfully felt by everyone around. So it's a drop of perfume in an ocean of water that it scents, or perfumes, or what did you say, like impresses, colors. Echoes pulls through that perfume scent is in all water everywhere. So the mind of awakening, when one begins to perceive the reality of it, the truth of it, it is like a drop of perfume in water. All water has that smell, that taste. All beings also have a more clear understanding of their awakening nature, because that is the ocean. So you know when you're around a teacher or somebody who has some kind of understanding, your own sense of understanding quickens. It's always nice just to hang out with him. That's what Ananda did. Good morning. Ananda was the Buddha's cousin. He hung out with the Buddha all the time, and so he thought he was right next door to the awakened. It was a great shock to him when he realized he wasn't. The Buddha was going to die. He said, "Oh, no! Wait a minute, I'm not ready." But this means I'll have to meditate. Because he had a real affinity for that sixth bowl. That guru devotion. Really opened his heart to that. And the seventh bowl is the most profound and most difficult to understand. It's food, it's the offering of food. And you say, all beings live by nutriment. The only thing you understand is life eats life. But the entire of the manifest creation is the Ouroboros. You know what the Ouroboros is? The snake that's eating its own tail? But it's the humongous snake, it's the great rainbow serpent of your aboriginals in Australia. The radiant energy dancing in and out of manifestation. The last thing that you have up there is a bell, because after having completed these seven offerings, and ding, the guru arises, the consciousness that hears is present. So the seven offering bowls are actually the path. as well as the experiential understanding, as well as aspiration of offering that you do for yourself and for all beings. And you do the offering bowls, you're also doing them for ultimately all beings, whatever place they are on that, on those seven stages of that path, etc., right? There are many ways to understand the seven bowls, but I think that's probably the best way in terms of beginning your practice, to understand what you're doing with them. And so they appear kind of on the bodily level, because that's like the first thing you can actually do, you know. Mm-hmm. And on the shrine, generally speaking, there are usually symbols, because whatever you put on the shrine is going to become what you focus on. Then, let's say, after 50,000 or so lifetimes, you develop the ability to think that, oh, maybe, okay, now, when I taught shrines, I don't know if you remember that, in Toronto many years ago, I had everybody make me shrines. I went to visit Joe Cash and Joe and Rob at their place, and they had Playboy pictures on their shrines. Is it true? Would you just see it?
I believe it, yes.
So it was really quite refreshing from going to other people's shrines and seeing pictures of myself, but still. Yeah. Because whatever you're going to focus on, you see, that's what you're working on.
So, where's that Playboy? Yeah, far up.
But, you know, after enough Playboy pictures and pictures of whoever your teacher is and this and that and the other, eventually you come down to just focusing on three principles, which is the principle of the body, the world of perception, which is represented by Buddha Rupa, principle of the speech, world of perception, which is represented by any written text, and the principle of mind, which is represented by stupa. Stupa is an ordering of the five elements in a balanced, harmonious way. Which is what mind does. So all things that you focus on eventually become awareness of how those three realms interact. So some people start with that. They say, well, it seems I'm going to get there anyway, I'll start with it. Some people start with Playboy pictures. So how's that? That's what a shrine is. One description. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So we've worked with ideas about loving kindness and compassion. Do you have any questions about those two?
About the three conceits that you were talking about, isn't the personality usually functioning in those three areas?
Yeah.
In relationship to the other world or people,
yeah.
Or because when you mention it, I keep seeing it here and there, everywhere.
That's right. And it is suffering. It's suffering because it's limited. Because it's our point of view. Does that make sense to you? Or should I say more?
Well...
You're wondering whether anything else is possible.
Well, what you're saying is there's something better than that. So why waste your time with it?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying it is suffering because it is limited. And if that's all there is, it's like the material world is suffering because it's limited. and there is only a material world. That's great suffering. By the same token, to deny the material world would be suffering because it's limited. You know, people who wander around and say, oh, it doesn't matter what happens in the world because all life is one. That is not wisdom. That's a limited view. Do you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
If somebody goes around saying, oh, you know, can only believe in what you see in the material world, it's where it's at. That's not wisdom. That's a limited view. Any operating in the three conceits is not wisdom. It is a limited view, therefore subject to all of the laws that accompany, all the cause and effect that follow ignorance. Whenever you're operating by ignoring some great truth, by ignorance, there is going to be suffering. I can ignore that curbs are a step down. As long as I'm walking on a sidewalk and it won't bother me at all, but the minute I step off the curb, I will have to learn something. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So say, like, to be operating within the three conceits, what one wants to know is that is what is happening. So the moment that there is a chance of moving out of those bounded states, to proceed in a boundless way, you're not just oblivious of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was sort of wondering how to relate to the three conceits so that you can be beneficial.
To be aware of them. To be aware of when you're operating. To be aware of when those are operating. That's really the most important. Because otherwise you're going to be burying them, hiding them, and then they're going to have results. Like if you're into being as good as everybody around you, then your whole life is going to be measured. All your reactions are going to be in terms. The only thing that's going to interest you is if you can do as much as people next door, you're going to become a real good consumer. Whether you're a consumer of spiritual products or material products, doesn't matter. And a basic sense of insecurity is never going to be addressed. So when you lose the power to consume, it's going to be very frightening. Understand?
Yeah.
For example. So what you want to do is first teach yourself to be aware of when those states are occurring. When you can be aware of just watching them, then you can start to see what feeling it is, what is the motive. As soon as you can feel the motive, you're already doing the flower offering. Then the consciousness will very easily begin to choose more wholesome ways of offering. And so that in the middle of practicing a conceit, suddenly you will think of sympathetic joy, and you'll actually listen to someone else and open your heart to their joy or compassion. These states of mind arise naturally. If the mind is not encumbered by ignorance, the boundless states arise naturally. So what you do is you practice awareness and try to see those conceits operating, and the ignorance becomes less, and the boundless states arise naturally. And then you're doing what my favorite subway sign says, you're minding the gap. Your mind is present in the gap between your conceits. Does that answer you?
Yeah, much more information on it. But I was wondering, they can be used too, no?
I'm not sure what you mean. Could you tell me what you mean?
Well, I was thinking yesterday out of courtesy or something, you know. Well, maybe I'm fooling myself, I don't know, but to talk to somebody and you want to be courteous to them, so you kind of play the game, like, almost, like.
Yeah, but then how you judge an action is by motive. How you judge an action is by motive. There's a really lovely saying, especially in Chinese Buddhism and Cambodian Buddhism, they say this, that an ordinary person cares about the effect. A being who is awakening cares about the cause. So one can perform an action that is to make everyone feel comfortable or at ease. Okay? One person will be performing that action because they don't want to be bothered by anyone. One person will be performing that same action because they really don't want anyone to be bothered. One person is performing that action, that is to say, the first person, from a sense of boredom or hatred with who's around. They don't want to be involved. Right? So the action, which looks the same from the outside, is actually a wall. They don't want anybody to interfere with their own particular brand of what they're doing in life, and so they make sure everything just moves on smoothly, right? So their action is actually a wall. They're doing that thing about the neutral person, like just making everything just neutral so they can just slide by without any problem. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
The other person will be performing that action because they really are practicing kindness toward other beings. So the action itself, which can look like the same action, but the actual effect that is occurring in the world is that people are sort of feeling comfortable and at ease with each other, and there isn't any difficulties happening. But the person who performs that action of using those, you know, those skills to make that effect happen, the cause of that is going to be quite different, you know, because that person is motivated to get away. The person who is motivated to get away, to wall off, is operating with hatred, and the sense of that is his consciousness will always try, because that perception is seated there. Oh, here comes people, I better wall them off. That perception is going to rule his life for quite a while, and he's going to be walling things off more and more. And as you wall off more and more, it leaves you in a narrower and narrower place to exist. So you end up in, classically, what is called hell state. Hell state means a place that has very tight corners. It's really hard to get out of that because you closed everything down. Whereas the other person is not doing that, they're practicing kindness, they're opening up, you know. So you understand what I'm saying, Alice?
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying it looks like the same from the outside, but it is the cause, it is the motive that is interesting. And the motive becomes very personal. The only person who really understands the motive is you. The real teacher is right there, looking at your eyes. Because you can feel how you feel when something is wholesome or unwholesome. You can feel, you know, the ups and downs and joys and strokes. When you hang out with people who have done that kind of work, that speeds up, so it's always nice to spend time with people who are teachers. Because insight and the power of clarity becomes stronger, you know, you vibrate more in tune with that when you're around it. So what the teacher does is affirms the teacher in you. Makes the teacher in you, you know, disturbed a bit. So maybe affirms it by causing you problems. I've had people come and say to me, I couldn't sleep all night after you left. It was just terrible. I think, oh, great. Far out. There's a teacher in them that is stirring. Not saying, ho hum, I guess we should, you know, clean up our act a little now. The suffering is so boring. So what you look at is the motive. And you're the one that can see it in yourself. I mean, other people can see it too, but they're probably not nearly so interested as you. You have the most invested in yourself. So if I were you, I'd take yourself as the first opinion at all times. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions from what we've done so far? So loving kindness can be summarized by that you start by saying that I live happily, and then you learn how to extend that out to others. And you extend it out, when you extend it out by doing it in a way that is easiest, most natural. You don't practice masochism by saying, okay, now I've practiced loving kindness with myself, so now I'm going to choose, you know, somebody that you have real difficulty with, to focus on loving kindness and see how good I am. Force yourself, because that's not practicing loving kindness, that's practicing ping pong. Loving kindness when it is developed. Well, more than that, in Buddhism, they talk about different mind states having near and far enemies. The near enemy, for example, of loving kindness is desire. Because they're very close, they're both open, mm-hmm. So one is very near the other. So one of the things you have to do is be careful when you're practicing loving kindness not to pick someone as the object for whom you might have desire, because it will very quickly turn from loving kindness, it will turn into desire rather than, and so the near enemy is called desire and the far enemy is called hatred, because hatred is the farthest state away from loving kindness. So if the mind is filled with hatred, it's impossible to do loving kindness. Probably better to work with compassion. After there is a sense of compassion, then you can work with loving kindness. Is it clear? The text here says it's not possible to practice loving kindness and feel anger. Compassion, you don't start by practicing, as I said, with the people in your home, in who are closest to. Because if you start to see the suffering of someone that you're living close to, first of all, either you don't see it, or second of all, if you do see it, it has much more impact on you. So, you know, if your son is maybe not going to do well at school this year, it's a real worry, and you have long conversations, you understand? Whereas if you're a person who lives three blocks away, their son is not doing well at school, so you wonder whether maybe they might ask them to go traveling for a year, you know? It's like much more distance, much easier to see. You're not caught in the grief, you know? The sense of the grief of it, the grief of having to deal with this pain that someone close to you is, and the wishing that they didn't suffer that grief, and You know, very often you'll say to children, why can't you just? Why can't you just dot, dot, dot? Was it ever said to anybody in this room? Anybody ever heard a parent say that to you? Why can't you just? Any of you? Just me? Any other one? All of you.
And it too.
And you say it to yourself. Because that's when compassion, when you feel someone's grief and you want it to end, when compassion falls over into grief, where you get caught in their grief. So that is the near enemy of compassion. Need, eh? So it says compassion has grief based on the home life as its near enemy. Since both share in seeing failure. And the example of the energy of the emotion, what the emotion feels like, is when a man either regards as a privation. Do you understand that? Privation is a privation. Do you understand that? No. When a man either regards as a loss or a suffering or an unjust action, something that he has been subjected to in a negative way. Okay? Privation, to not have, to have been robbed of, or unjustness in a certain quality, there's a certain quality of unjust lack involved with privation. Okay, when a man, it could be a woman too, by the way, a child, a dog, a cat, a parrot. When a man either regards as a privation failure to obtain visible objects, cognizable by the eye, so when you see something and you also recognize it, like a BMW, for example, that are sought after, objects that are sought after, desired, agreeable, gratifying, and associated with worldliness, that is to say, associated with pleasure or success or fame or etc. It can also be the opposites of those. Or when he recalls those formerly obtained that are past, ceased, changed, then grief arises. Isn't it? That's when grief arises. Such grief as this is called grief based on the home life. So grief based on the home life is a near enemy of compassion. And the far enemy of compassion is cruelty. When you wish someone harm, then you can't practice compassion. So when you wish someone harm, you would go and work with loving kindness. Or sympathetic joy, but probably loving kindness. Do you see that? Is that pretty clear? Now, gladness has joy based on the home life as its near enemy. Because one can get caught in thinking that the attainment of something is permanent, is itself. I went to WordFest and in Calgary, it was 4 days of wonderful writing and reading. And Margaret Atwood was there, and when she was introduced at one reading she gave to the two readings, she said, when the person who was introducing her was the editor of the Calgary Herald, was running through all the list of prizes and attainments, she said, she got up at the microphone and she said, I have a new song, and she's a terrible singer, by the way. She said, and I'll sing it to you. And she went, you must remember this. A prize is just a prize. A review is just a review. The only thing that's left is the work you do as time goes by. Very good. And in a way, that's the answer. You know, that's what is being represented here, is that the wholesome feelings or the joyous feelings you feel in the home life, that is, by getting what you want, or the people you love getting what they want, and so forth, the enemy to sympathetic joy. Because it is not in itself anything of value or permanent. It is based on conditions and subject to change and grief. It is not a boundless state, it's a bounded state. And what we are working with here are the boundless states, the states that are not subject to conditions. Now, once you develop them and then strengthen them in the proper way, they are not subject to condition in any condition once you have developed these states. You can practice them. You can just say, oh, loving kindness, that's what I need to do. And you just recall it and working your perception that way. No matter what environment, practice it. That's why these states are taught. Because they are actually unconditioned, not tainted by conditioning. If the proper work is done, they will just arise. And therefore, they make it easier to attain liberation. And you can see how that is true, I'm assuming. Can you see how that is true? But if you know what a boundless state is, then you're not going to be so caught. You have a better feeling of what is consciousness. You're not so attached to a self. If you feel comfortable in a boundless state, then it doesn't seem so necessary to cling to a self so desperately. So in some practices, it is considered very important to experience what is called jhana, or absorption, or blissful states, because they soften the consciousness from its rigidity. Most often the consciousness is rigidly clinging to a sense of self because of fear. So what do you do with fear? Just make it like this. Oh, da, da, da. So you get a good shot of universal bliss and a sense of and consciousness thinks that maybe it might go outdoors more often. So gladness has joy based on the home life as its near enemy, since both share in seeing success. What gladness depends on when you're working with gladness is it depends on being able to see the success of consciousness. So you start by, in the text, it briefly mentions it, and my beloved teacher, Namjong Rinpoche, often taught in earlier days, about how the development of sympathetic joy is easily done by watching children learn things, like very young children learning how to walk, or I'm watching, and there is a sense of joy at consciousness learning that is in a way very boundless. It's like it is not attached, it isn't my child, it's just this sense of joyousness about watching consciousness perform well or perform success. Compassion arises from being focused on the grief, right? Not home grief, but grief and suffering, and compassion develops. Sympathetic joy develops by focusing on the success. But you wouldn't want to focus too much on the success of your family or yourself, because then it becomes ambition and pride and conceive and obsession. And, do you understand?
So it's bounded. Delusion.
Yeah.
If it's
it will easily get bounded because of the attachment.
Yeah.
So, when a person either regards as gain the obtaining of visible objects, cognizable by the eye, that are sought, and associated with worldliness, or recalls those formerly obtained that are past, seized and changed, joy arises in him. Such joy as this is called joy based on the home life. So it's that sense of identifying with achieving, or feeling that, oh yeah, I'm really good because I got this. Aversion or boredom, because you see the main thing that is happening with success is interest. Just like with loving kindness, the main thing that's happening is beauty, is liking. Oh, you look, feel good. Oh, I like that. So liking, so the far enemy of loving kindness is hatred, not liking. Oh. So with sympathetic joy, the far enemy is boredom. No interest. And it is, isn't it? Exactly that. So if someone is totally bored or unable to open, then they cannot practice sympathetic joy. Best for them probably to, you need to find out where their interest is, but best for them probably to start practicing loving kindness with themselves. And that will begin to stir the energy to move up, expand out. It is not possible to practice gladness and be discontented. So, when one is practicing gladness, usually one would start with someone who is not very close but who is admired, because it's very easy to feel happiness about a dear friend but who is not very, you know, very emotionally close, someone you admire and feel great respect for. Like for many people, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, there was this great sympathetic joy that arose because he's admired, he's dear, and there was success. So that's how you start with sympathetic joy. That's the consciousness that you would focus on first. That makes sense to you? And you would, and the text mentions that one of the best examples of sympathetic joy is how you feel watching a child, and so that would be probably second. You would do that, although you could do with a child first, because but you don't get the same quality of. Like, I think a child, you tend to box it more. You tend to think, oh, yeah, well, it's okay for them. You know what I mean? When you see a child learning something, you tend to think, oh, well, they're innocent. And do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm glad. Any of you don't understand what I'm saying?
I'm not sure what you're saying.
I'm saying that I think the quality of the consciousness that is focusing on someone who you admire, for whom your mind feels great friendship, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, when they get something, some award or some joyous thing occurs in their life, the sympathetic joy is not not, it's just quite open, because you have a sense that they are like you, living in the same world.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you practice sympathetic joy with a child, there is a sense that they're unencumbered by, you know,
mm-hmm.
that everything is supplied for them, kind of. Do you understand?
So they're not similarly situated in a way.
Yeah, they're not similarly, exactly, thank you.
Yeah.
They're not similarly situated, and so that there is a bit of a kind of an inner, a perceptive sense that, well, after all, it's easier for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I would recommend that you do as the text does, that you do the person who is someone you admire greatly, and you think about their successes, or maybe they have really beautiful eyebrows, so you consider how lovely their eyebrows are. You know, whatever you think they've accomplished, that you want to focus on their accomplishment, their success. And then you feel the joy of that. You feel the joy of how they do that. And then probably you can focus a little more on yourself and feel that consciousness about things that you have accomplished well, watching that you don't get into things that meant that you were as good as,
mm-hmm.
but that you actually had a sense of joy about, and then go back to that person again. Go back and forth, and then try with a child. And try to remove that sense of your own preference for thinking it's easier as a child or something like that, because it isn't. You know, it isn't. And whether it is or not, that's not the point. The point is what you're trying to develop is sympathetic joy, boundlessly. So having done that with a child, then you can start working on being able to perceive someone riding on a bus, or someone who is neutral, someone standing in a shop, someone sitting at a class behind you right now, or in front of you right now. You know, and perceive the sense of their success that is present, and try to allow that sympathetic joy to arise as well. And what you do with that is very simple, you know. You begin to identify that sympathetic joy is the spreading quality of consciousness. That consciousness, when it's moving out, is joyous. Do you understand what I'm saying here? So you begin to look at consciousness, no matter where it is, and see the joyous quality of it when it is spreading out. When someone is spreading out. Then you realize that every human being, or every being that takes manifestation, is consciousness spreading out in through the five elements. So you see all beings, no matter who they are, what they are, whatever they're doing, as the joyous manifestation of the Bodhisattva in the world of time and space, dancing enlightenment by being a rapist, moving their path to enlightenment, diving into the fire here, to submerge in the light here. So you begin to be able to identify the joyous quality of consciousness, learning, awakening, the success, no matter where you see consciousness arising. Is that clear?
I don't understand what you mean, the relationship between consciousness spreading out and the private home.
Consciousness spreading out is interest. That's sympathetic joy. So once you perceive that quality of sympathetic joy as being not different than interest, what we call interest, then wherever you see interest, no matter what it is, recognizing the innate nature of consciousness to spread to its most boundless state. So when you see interest absolutely attached to bounded states, like pain, suffering, grief, old age, despair, lamentation, taxes, death, and etc., Ralph Klein's mind, you know, wherever you see it manifesting, you know that what is occurring is the consciousness moving through what seems like incredible ignorance toward the boundless state of awakening. And so there is sympathetic joy for consciousness manifesting in the five elements in order to move towards enlightenment. Is that clear?
I think so. In a way, you're saying that the five elements are human form, so the manifestation of the consciousness through that form.
An interest in it.
The human form arises because consciousness takes the five elements and shapes them into a tool that is capable of acting out the desires. And all desires move toward enlightenment. Sympathetic joy is basically Roger, you're being and making desire into a virtue. Interest. Taking that thirst, hunger, which is only satisfied when it has eaten everything. So you can understand why sympathetic joy would not be one of the ones you practice first. You can't practice sympathetic joy as long as you're caught by right or wrong. You cannot, because so long as the temporal world has more power than the eternal world, you can't practice sympathetic joy.
So judging
in
Ralph
a
Klein,
total way.
Yeah. Judging Ralph Klein just isn't it. It's the interest in what he does.
Yeah.
Boy, that's hard.
It is hard. It is hard. And so you can see, like, these days require practice. They require actually practice. And you do always, if you really want to be successful with these states, which I recommend doing these different practices, it's a wonderful thing to do. Start small. Start small, because even a small amount of these practices is powerful in your life. It changes your life. Even a small amount. So I'm just going to read very quickly what it says here classically by Buddha Ghosa, what the Venerable Buddha Ghosa 1500 years ago wrote about how to develop sympathetic joy, which he calls gladness through the mouth of his translator. In Pali, it's called Karuna. Do you remember, how many of you read, what was it called? Was it Huxley that wrote?
Brave New World?
Yeah, Brave New World. And there were two birds in it. and one says here and now, here and now, here and now, and the other says karuna, karuna, karuna. Two minor birds, karuna, gladness. One who begins the development of gladness, got it all totally wrong. Karuna is compassion, and that's what the bird says. And gladness is mudita. One who begins the development of gladness should not start with the dear person and the rest, for a dear person is not the proximate cause of gladness, merely in virtue of dearness. How much less the neutral and the hostile person? So don't start with somebody who is dear, somebody who is neutral, or somebody who is hostile. One of the opposite sex and one who is dead are also not a good field to start with. Because you're going to plant a seed, so they're all fields, right? The very dear companion can be the proximate cause, can be the person you start working with. One who in the commentaries is called a boon companion. For he is constantly glad, he laughs first and speaks afterward. Somebody who is a good companion, a good time friend, who laughs first and speaks afterward. So they should be the first to be pervaded with gladness, or on seeing or hearing about a dear person being happy, cheerful, and glad, gladness can be aroused. By thinking, this being is indeed glad, how good, how excellent. This is what is referred to in the Vibhanga, which is one of the texts. How does a bhikkhu, a monk, dwell, pervading one direction with his heart imbued with gladness? Just as he would be glad on seeing a dear and beloved person, so he pervades all beings with gladness. You see why I'm using the word interest? The heart opens with interest. Interest is a near neighbor of love. But if his boon companion or the dear person was happy in the past but is now unlucky and unfortunate, then gladness can still be aroused by remembering the past happiness and apprehending the glad aspect in this way. In the past he had great wealth, a great following, and he was always glad. Or gladness can be aroused by apprehending the future glad aspect in him in this way. In the future he will again enjoy aspects like this. He will enjoy similar success and will go about in gold, in the gold palanquin. Well, maybe he wouldn't want to take that. That might be where you bring in the BMW or something. But maybe you want to think of gold palanquin. Maybe you don't. So imagine can we carry through the streets in a gold palanquin? Maybe. It's all possible. Might be interesting in Edmonton. Maybe that's what the mayor will do.
Likely.
You just never know. On the backs of elephants or on horseback. I think backs of elephants is good for Edmonton, too. something to be said for the sympathetic joy that could naturally arise from thinking of seeing people, all your older persons riding through Edmonton on the backs of elephants. That could be quite good. I think they meant this. It's kind of a nice idea. And just as he would be glad on seeing a dear and beloved person, so he pervades all beings with gladness. But if his boon companion or the dear person was happy, oh, I did that, didn't I? Yeah, we got the elephants. Having thus aroused gladness with respect to a dear person, he can then direct it successfully toward a neutral one and after that toward a hostile one. But if resentment toward the hostile one arises in him, the way already described, he should make it subside in the same way as described under loving kindness, that is to say, go back one step, go back to the child, or go back to the person you revere, the person who's always happy. He should break down the barriers by means of mental impartiality toward the four, that is, toward these three and himself. Do you understand that? And that's really the crux of what I'm saying about the difference between perception and moment. You unhook perception and moment. They're hooked together. Cause one to treat things inappropriately. So, break down the barrier. Break down the barriers by means of mental impartiality. So that mentally, your mind is not hooked to the to emotional states of I want, I don't want, I don't like. You can look at someone and practice a sense of loving or something, a situation. You can look at the world and see it through the eyes of loving kindness. You can look at the world, see it through the eyes of compassion. You can look at the world and see it through the eyes of sympathetic joy. You can look at the world and see it through the eyes of equanimity. Your choice. You have four ways of being in the world. You don't look at the world and see it in terms of being caught by your own hopes and fears. And that's what this is the practice for. It's called breaking down the barriers. And the three in himself are the person, the dear person, the neutral person, and the undear person. And four is oneself, sort of the four types of people. By cultivating that sign, developing and repeatedly practicing it, by becoming aware of what sympathetic joy is, so you arouse it because there's a subject, there's an object, sympathetic joy is the motive that runs between it. You let go of the subject and the object, you hold the motive, and then you practice it in all directions, moving from direct places that it's easy to move to the places that it isn't, so that your focus becomes the motive, not the object and not the subject. And you develop the skill with that motive. You develop a skill with that motive, and you keep going at it and going at it and going at it. If you do that by practicing that sign, developing and repeatedly practicing it, then it becomes a total absorption into that state of joy, so that wherever you look, there is consciousness expanding in joyousness. And one can achieve to third jhana, formless jhana, through that state. Loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy all bring the mind to third jhana, formless jhana, to the third stage of formless jhana, the most subtle level. Which is called neither perception nor non-perception. That is to say, you're not perceiving an object, you're not perceiving an object. You're not perceiving a subject, you're not perceiving a subject. The consciousness is riding on the energy of interest, not on what it perceives or what it doesn't perceive. So the object is the energy of interest, or sympathetic joy in this case. So there is neither perception nor non-perception. There's a boundless state of being aware of consciousness flooding in all directions, no matter what is there, it becomes. You identify with the consciousness of whatever you're looking at. So this consciousness that's in really interesting consciousness. So in a way, this is only my own simile, I find the first meditation is like going to a movie and watching the figures on the movie and thinking how beautiful. You know, how beautiful to be involved with the picture and think how beautiful this picture is. The second meditation on compassion is to be aware of the screen on which the movie is playing. and realize how the screen is empty and can take any shape or any form or any. That's compassion. And the third one is to begin to see the light that is flooding through the air and hitting the screen, to see the nature of consciousness spreading with interest.
Cecily, I find that when the mind is trying to focus on interest or curiosity or questioning, immediately there's a move towards evaluating and making a statement or judgment or something. Even if it's not a harsh one, it just seems to gravitate that way. How can you
Well, you just take that and you turn it right back. Sure, the intellect comes in and names. That's right. That's what you're saying. The intellect comes in and names. Isn't that what you're saying?
I think it goes beyond names.
Hello? Why? What do you think?
It's evaluating it. Or it's going beyond naming.
What can be beyond naming?
Saying whether it's good or bad or...
It's a name.
Okay. Or I like it, I don't like it. It feels good, name.
Those are names. Those are the way you draw back and know something.
Okay.
And then you stack up a bunch of names and you presume that if you get enough names that makes it real, and so you call that a judgment or a person. But it's all the naming principle, basically. So it's basically the separating principle, which has to separate mind and name. And so that's what you're talking about. Telling why that separateness happens, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay, well, say your question again, because maybe obviously I'm not doing this properly.
When there's awareness of something, an event, a person, a sensation, whatever, it doesn't stop there.
It doesn't stop there.
No.
Yeah. And
so, on.
Yes, it does move on. And?
But that's very limiting.
Why is that limiting?
Does it naming it?
Why does the naming keep on? Do you keep saying brick, 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 brick? That's kind of fun.
And if it's something I don't like,
it's there all the time.
Isn't that interesting? So the mind is stuck in aversion.
Mm-hmm. Or in a hatred state or
whatever. Aversion is hatred, yeah. That's it, mine is stuck in aversion, so obviously maybe you should practice some loving kindness.
But then it seems to get back to what Otto was saying about how contrived or how unreal and how forced.
Well, let us just say that the naming principle is basically moving in time. Moving in time and space, coming into the manifest. This is naming principle. Back into the world of totality, if you're just at eye level again, this is being principle. Naming principle, being principle. I'm so sorry, you prefer being principle. Well, geez, that's too bad. Because as long as you keep trying for the being principle, the more you focus on trying to get that, the more you're going to bring the naming principle right around for you to look at. It's the law of opposites, you know?
Mm.
I don't want to be involved with time and space.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I'm going to put it down totally, so you push it down, so just as you turn your back to look at totality consciousness, because you don't want to be involved with form, you only want emptiness. And you learn form is not separate from emptiness, emptiness is not that separate from form. How do you learn that? So, I'm only going to be aware of emptiness. Oh yeah, that's, damn! It's more like a pendulum. Without emptiness, there is no form. Without form, there is no emptiness. I start working with emptiness. The closer you come to it, the more form arises from it. Start working with form, and the closer you come to it, the more emptiness arises from it. So if this judgment arises, then you can just look at it. You know, your perception of it is what gives it such solidity. Your sense of, oh damn, there's that judgment again, or else, oh, I must take this judgment seriously. But it's just naming.
Mm-hmm. Well, another related question is, when we look you're distinguishing, I think, between behavior and motive? Or is that right?
I think I was distinguishing between perception and motive.
Okay.
I don't think I distinguish between behavior and motive.
Okay,
perception. Where the motive is, the behavior will be.
Pardon?
What the motive is, the behavior will be. It's pretty well, that's very difficult to separate. But perception and motive is pretty simple to separate. Once you look at it.
Well, maybe my question is, how sure can we be of the nature of our motive? Because for me, it's confusing. Sometimes I think the motive is quite good, but then there's doubt and...
Yeah, so one would say that you have a very powerful analytical mind. Wouldn't one say that?
Maybe.
Couldn't you say that about your life? Like everything you're saying suggests that, you know? Like when you think, then judgment comes up, you know? Or when you have an aspiration, then doubt comes up. What's strange about it is that you dislike the analysis. So you keep trying to pretend it's not happening. Nice.
Well,
okay,
it gets in the way sometimes.
You've heard this from me before.
Yes, I have.
Barbie?
Yes, I have.
Isn't it rotten? You think I'd learn, eh? Well, I just keep learning on the same thing.
Well, I'm sure you learned it. It's me.
See how nice she is? Barbie. You know Barbie and Ken? As if anybody in this room didn't know it. As if I'm not just driving the nail in. You know those dolls? Without genitals? You know what I mean? They're so pleasing. So what is the intellect that can be so precise about what should be pleasing? It's a beautiful intellect there. You really should look at that intellect. That intellect has this superb precision and grace. You have a beautiful intellect. I admire it especially in how you sculpt yourself into little acceptable bites, allowing yourself to survive. Thank my God, that woman is talented. One millimeter more and you would kill yourself. Barbie? So what you want to look at is the beauty of intellect rather than if only it would go away. Huh? Look at what it is you're trying to get rid of. Because you really don't want to get rid of it. It's very beautiful. It's a beautiful tool. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I think I have to think about it.
Yeah, okay.
So you, with this beautiful intellect, it can be quite self-lacerating.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
You acknowledge it.
You acknowledge what it is that is the essential motive of it. And what is it that intellect wants? It wants truth.
Order. And
truth.
Truth?
Yeah, truth is just like when everything is orderly, is when you see things as they are.
Mm-hmm.
And the essential quality it's after is what in Buddhism is called Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
So intellect is really the desire for truth, its refuge in Dharma.
It's just misguided.
Yeah, you think that somehow if you weren't there, everything would be all right. That is to say, truth would be attained.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the world weren't there, everything would be all right. That is to say, truth would be attained. And we have to see that truth is attained in every moment. And intellect is singing the beauty of truth with knowing that itself. Naming what is. Not creating names to make what is acceptable to the greater mass. What is refuge. That's true. That there is a naming mind is refuge. Form is not separate from emptiness, neither is emptiness separate from form. Perception is not separate from emptiness, neither is emptiness separate from perception. Perception does not have to be tied to more. Perception is perception, not separate from emptiness. Feeling is not separate from emptiness, neither is emptiness separate from emptiness. Feeling is just a dancing energy. I know, so I know. You want that to be you? I don't think so. It's not how you look to me. Break down the barriers by means of mental impartiality. That is to say, mentation, naming, not tied to praise and blame. Seeing things as they are of a compassionate, unclinging awareness. And that's something that the intellect desires. That's where you want to go. Seeing things as they are. Mm-hmm. Compassion. That's not coldly. Compassion. Non-clinging. That's not going around in little eddies. I'm going to call them eddies. We're not Olivers or Harrys. We're not little Harrys. No, awareness. Thank you. So we're going to take a break right now, and then we'll come back and we'll do a half an hour of very quick play with. And then we'll have questions and answers. So we'll have a 20-minute break right now. Is that good? Give everybody time to stretch and relax. Is 20 minutes enough, or do you want more? 20 minutes good? Okay. That's what you feel. You don't want. You don't categorize. You don't say good or bad. You just observe. This is the training of the intellect. You see what arose. You watch at which point, usually when you do the practice of loving kindness this way, spatially, there's like two places anyway. Some people have more, but usually two places where the mind actually has to switch gears, like a car going up a hill. Did you feel that happening? Usually sometimes for some people it's when you go from the inner solar system to the outer solar system, that their mind just says, oh, I can't do that. And if you just keep holding it, and something goes click, and then you've got some kind of different feel of it. There's usually two places in that, moving out and moving back in, where there's like a gear change. And then it changes what it is. So where was that?
Little pieces of it. It was drifting in and out.
Okay, that's another question. Mm-hmm. Then you ask yourself, just look in your own mind at your own practice and you ask yourself, okay, was the mind really concentrated or was it going away on holidays all the time?
Some concentration, some holidays.
Yeah, so you just say, okay, where did the holidays occur? And that's something that you find interesting next time you do it. You ask that question again. And it's not unlikely that there will be a similar place every time when you go on a holiday. So then when you get to that place in the meditation, you try to practice loving kindness toward yourself there specifically. Just be curious what makes you go on a holiday there.
What was easier, going out or coming back in? Sometimes when you're coming back in, when you're going out the first few times you do the practice, you really think you're not doing it. If you come back in, you can feel your mind actually. You say, oh, it must have expanded. Well, I'll be. I thought I was just way too old. Because it does expand. Because consciousness is capable of being permeating all space while here. It's your familiarity with time that makes you feel like when you move outside of moving into boundless states, which you do by increasing boundary. If, you know, that sense of self starts to get a little wobbly, so you say, oh, I can't do this. Well, it's true, I can. But non-I is doing it all the time. Mm-hmm. So you're thinning that distinction. Critical mind, it's true when you say, oh, I'm not doing it well, write that down. It's true. But I isn't the one who does it anyway, so that's fine. Excellent, excellent observation. That's true. I can't do it. That's true. But not I has no problem. Out, in, up, down, poof. Then you ask, how much restlessness was there? Tell me something, when you scratch, Wayne, does it make itching stop?
Did it quite stop?
Itching.
No, well, itching starts up with cells.
So, what happens if you don't scratch? You don't know because you never tried it.
No, I...
So don't you answer me. You have not tried it. No, you have focused on the itching and wondered what it was going to do next, and was it more or less, and when it got less, you thought, is it really, or is it going to go somewhere else, which is not the same thing as not scratching.
Okay, it's not the same.
No, you're scratching with your mind.
Okay.
Like a chicken. I'm telling you this because now it's time for you to observe the fact that if you scratch, it just itches more.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just note it and say feeling, not itch, oh, there's a feeling and I'm in my heart. Just like you can do with sound. A car goes by, you don't say, oh, there's a car, I'm going to go out and stop traffic. Do you?
No.
In fact, it doesn't bother you.
No.
It's because of the sense that self is supposed to do something with it. So that creates the restless mind. So you're making more itches appear every time you do that. Every time you shift. It's just feeling, it comes, it goes, ho-hum. Meanwhile, did I actually experience a shift of consciousness? And sometimes, itching is very interesting when it arises. Once you quit being addicted to thinking you're supposed to... If pain in the leg is so unwholesome, but you can't focus on anything else, then you move. Mm-hmm. Otherwise you just say, sit there and say, oh yeah, that's feeling, and I'm looking at expanding and contracting the mind. I know I'm not going to die of that itch within the next half hour, and that's how long this meditation is going to last. You know, if a cougar is eating your leg or something, maybe you move, because you might die, you know, and you want to learn how to perfect this meditation while you've got this body. Do you understand? But if you really want to make some progress, don't be so cheap. Up your price. It has to be a cougar or I'm not moving. You understand?
No.
Because it doesn't work, is why. That's why I'm asking you now. I haven't said anything to you before, have I? We've known each other, what, 3 years?
That, yes.
Yeah, and I haven't once said to you, why are you itching, right? Now I can ask you, because the mind is capable of looking at this. Before that, it would have made you more agitated. You would have just made a bunch of rules. Oh, I'm not supposed to move. So you wouldn't, your mind would still be itching, but you would have a rule about it. Whereas now I'm saying, look at it from the point of view of what is it that makes you want to scratch? Does it make the scratch go away? No. So put your focus somewhere else. Oh yeah, that's feeling, and I'm here. Oh yeah, that's a car going by, and I'm here.
you know. Too cheap. You're too cheap, you know.
Gotcha.
Make yourself more expensive. Get a raise. Say, I'll move if the Buddha comes down and tell me I'm blessed amongst all creatures. Okay, I'll move then. Oh, thank you. Glad we both acknowledge that. But nothing so cheap as, like, you know. Get better bribes. They'll come. If you don't fall for the cheap bribes, you know, then the consciousness will, instead of producing an itch to see if you can be distracted, will start producing angels and views of the solar system from another place. You want success in meditation, don't buy yourself off so cheap. Just sit there when you're not successful and be curious. Well, what kind of not successful am I? Mm-hmm. And then you begin to see a point of view that is not usually open to you. Because you won't be believing your present perception. Your present perception is based on experiences you have had to date. So if you keep believing those perceptions, you keep going back in the past. You never get out of the realm of samsara. You need a new experience. Enlightenment is vipaka. You need a new perception, a new experience. So you have to feel the old twinges and say, oh, well, where is the mind? And what about you? And what's different? But push it a bit. Don't be so cheap. Ask for a little more money. A little more return. A little more energy. Does that make sense to you? It works, yeah. It will really help you practice. So you have to know when to follow that advice. I mean, I think so anyway. I think it saves time. Although I know in some practices like Zen and so forth, right from the beginning, you do not move. But, you know, I think that for some people, what they would do is just make that into how good they could withstand pain and teach themselves not to feel the pain rather than to feel the pain but realize that's not what they're looking at. Feel the pain and it's not going to kill them. They like cut off the feeling of pain, which is greater ignorance. You know, it's falling into right wrong. We're going to perform. But liberation is not a performance. It's a result. Liberation from suffering is not a performance. It's a result. Result of lessening of ignorance, greater joy, greater freedom. Did you find that exercise interesting, that meditation interesting? Another way to do loving kindness is to do it by categories, and so then there are two different ways of doing it by categories. One is by doing it with different types of people. Well, there's three. The categories, there are probably as many ways as you want to do it, really. But there are three. The one that they do here, which I have never done. In the top of, I've done one that's more complicated than that. Where you go, may I be well and happy, free of enmity, free of disease and grief. May I guard myself happily, or may I live happily. As I am, may all humans on this planet, all humans in any planet, in any world, outside this planet, outside this world, as I am, may all mammals on this planet, may all mammals outside of this world, as I am, may all reptiles on this planet, all reptiles on another world, as I am, may all water-dwelling, non-mammals, water-dwelling creatures on this planet or another world, as I am, may all kind of natural spirits, what do you call them, like elementals on this planet, on other worlds, as I am all angels on this planet, the lower forms of angels on this planet, on other worlds, as I am all insects on this planet, on other worlds, as I am hungry ghosts and unhappy spirits on this planet and on the world, as I am may all hell state beings on this planet and on the world, as I am may all formless state gods on this planet and on the world, although it's hard to say other worlds, but my awareness of the contacting them here or anywhere and doorway into their presence here or anywhere. It is more like what you do not know. And then may all plants on this planet, on the worlds, and then may all formation, all rocks, like all, especially rocks, form, earth kind of thing, on this planet, and then throughout space, and you open your mind and try to become aware of all the planets everywhere in space. And then you focus on one planet and you fold it up, disappear. You say, may everybody help. You focus on form and you reduce the form to a dot, you disappear the dot, and then consciousness is working in space. My beloved teacher, Nyingchen Rinpoche, amongst other people who have done this practice, but he did it with the LaRousse Encyclopedia of Animals, and he went through all the categories of animals, practicing loving kindness to all of them, visualizing them, focusing on them, reading about their habitat, wishing loving kindness for them in their habitat. That's one of the things he did. Then when he finished that, it took him a little while, then he wanted an up-to-date, newer version of the LaRousse Encyclopedia. Typical. Another way of developing loving kindness is by the category of people close to you. First, a teacher, then your parents. If you have a good relationship with your parents, it's helpful. Then a dear friend, and then a neutral person, and then a person who is for whom you have antipathy. And then a person for whom you have anger. Just for to do categories as well, but categories by people. And then another way to practice loving kindness is to do the practice by doing the Loving Kindness Sutra and taking each line, operating it, the Karaniyama Metta Sutta. In many monasteries and in many places, they chant that every day. It's very beautiful. And it goes through, and there are different phrases in that practice that are just quite superb. One of them is, do as much as one is able. That's a rule for loving kindness. I do more, and I do less. Do as much as one is able. It's a very nice little bumper sticker to put on the inside of your forehead. Do as much as one is able. What else should I say about loving kindness? In the Tibetan tradition, you do the four immeasurables.